My name is Father Gregory Pine, and welcome back to the Thomistic Institute podcast for this off-campus conversation, during which we follow up with speakers who have given lectures on campus or participated in conferences, so that way we can chase down some of the insights that they will have set forth in their lectures or conferences. And for this episode or this installment of Off-Campus Conversations, I'm delighted to be joined by Professor Michael Pakalik. Thanks so much for joining.
You're quite welcome, Father. Great to be here with you.
So your name will be familiar to many listeners from lectures that you've given that have appeared on the podcast, also from your wife's name, which is your name, which is that how those things typically work or often work, because she was just on Off-Campus Conversations. For those who don't know you, though, would you say a word of who you are, where you're from, and what you do?
Well, I'm an ordinary professor of ethics and social philosophy in the Bush School of Business at the Catholic University of America. And I work on Aristotelian ethics and theory of society generally, and theory of a free society, you might say.
Okay. I talked to your wife just a little bit about the Bush School, but I was talking recently to a German student from Münster, whose name I've forgotten right now. And he was describing how one of like the organizing or thematically integrating principles of the Bush School is virtue. Is that right? Or how is that so?
Well, some people say that. I don't really like it, frankly. Why should virtue be a distinctive organizing principle of a business school as opposed to a law school or a nursing school or a school of arts and sciences? And we're all in the business of seeking holiness, and holiness means that we acquire the virtues. So I don't like at all this kind of presupposition that there's something dubious about business activity, and therefore we have to say, well, we're doing it virtuously, and therefore, you know, we should be patted on the back. I think that that's a huge mistake, and I don't want to sort of play into that. It is true that by attention to the virtues, a lot of discussion of ethics in relation to business can be filled out appropriately, and you can begin thinking about it in a more real way and more profitably. But also, I mean, one has to say equal attention at least is given to the Bush School to the principles of Catholic social thought and the tradition of Catholic social thought going back to Rerum Novarum, Centesimus Annus, and the classical roots of those teachings.
Okay. So virtue not as a dialectical claim, as if the presumed basis of business praxis were rapacious greed, and that we undertake to live virtuously as a way by which to redress the excesses of our contemporaries. But virtue insofar as it's intelligible and it affords you entry into the body of thought or the tradition of thought which informs business practices within the Catholic tradition, roughly speaking?
Well put.
All right.
Very well said.
So thinking then, maybe we can just think further about a theme related to virtue, and specifically as, you know, we're trying to live peaceably in society to build up the common good. In order to do so, we need to cultivate healthy relationships of some sort. And we'll often talk about it in terms of friendship. I was hoping that you could lead us into the theme of friendship. I think maybe one place to start is when a lot of people hear friendship, they think elective friendship. They think a kind of commonality which begets a certain affection, which I then choose and may or may not persevere in depending upon time and fate and adventitious circumstances. But when thinking about friendship kind of in the classical tradition, where do you start? Because it seems like when you're talking about political friendship or civic friendship or kind of societal friendship, that it embraces a broader notion of relationship than just what strikes your fancy and what you choose to cling to.
Yeah, I think it's a really good point. And the term friendship, I think, is misleading, really. And I always look for alternatives. So what you call elective friendship, was that your term? Heteira kephalia is a Greek term. Companionate friendship, friendship of choice among a handful of close others. That is certainly something we'd call under the heading of friendship in the classical world. But maybe in some sense it's a phenomenon you need to look at to understand best what's going on in any case of friendship. But in Aristotle's treatment, for example, he has two full books in the Nicomachean Ethics. altogether, am I counting correctly, over 20 chapters, and you do have to maybe three or four to that kind of friendship that you're talking about. And the rest is, very wide ranging. So the Greek word is philia, and it's related to the word for love, whereas our term friend, although originally, if you go back, 1,000 years, it has its roots in a word related to love. It no longer shows that connection with love. So I actually prefer to use, as far as I can get away with it, the term social union. I think that he's interested in social union or bonding. And what he sees is that human beings hardly ever just live, want to. If you use this notion of want, and you get at what's spontaneous and what's natural for us, it's we don't need to be coerced. Nobody needs to instruct us or guide us. In basically any setting in which we find ourselves, we are grouping together in various ways and for various purposes. And this fascinates him, I think, because he has this discussion of the three species or forms of friendship, and he sees that some friendships play the purpose of essentially entertaining us and helping us refresh ourselves and recreate, and some are very productive. They help us to flourish and to prosper. We would say, and then others are just kind of free and for leisure, which is really different. Leisure has kind of more serious character than just recreation and refreshment. And he sees that in any one of those contexts, we are bonding with others. And so I think that fascinates him. I think he thinks there has to be something in human nature then that leads us to do this. If you will, it's his investigation almost you from a more phenomenological point of view or subjective point of view of what he says in the politics when he says that human beings are by nature political, or probably a better term is city dwelling or civic animals.
So in making reference to this threefold division or distinction, which you reference between what, yes, some people will say is use, pleasure, or noble, virtuous, substantive goods. It seems like you can approach this question of social union from the basis of need, in the sense that, all right, there are certain goods to which we don't have access until such time as we congregate. I mean, procreation and education of children being the most clear. But you can also approach it from, it's not like a totally different approach. Maybe it's a helpful approach regardless. But this idea of like communicatio, that like there's a certain affinity or there's a certain kind of tendency to constitute friendships on the basis of certain things around which we're going to naturally congregate. I'm trying to think like, I suspect that that's hard for a lot of people in the 21st century to think. I don't think about it well, so I don't know how hard it is for other people to think about well, but this idea that there are certain goods which call for a response or which call for us to congregate about because they're like humanity constituting. Can you like break down the notion of like what gets us out of ourselves and into the public square? What is it that draws us into these societal unions? How do we recognize that?
Well, I really have studiously tried to avoid any kind of language or thinking which would lead us into a tired and I think misleading track of dividing up human affection into the egoistic and the altruistic. And that polarity, that division, I think is not true to human nature. It's not classical. Its origin, I don't want to spend too much time thinking about. But I would say Aristotle's view is, which I think is the correct view, is that social union or bonding, which originates in need, so yes, of course, economic activity originates in need, has a friendly character to it. So what you call communicatio, it would be exchange. There has to be some kind of exchange. But exchange always involves recognizing the good of the other person and taking his good as your own good. This takes place even in barter. In a marketplace, you have to see what it is that you can provide to another person and look at an exchange in the marketplace as for his good so that you can then get something that you need in return. He has to look at what he has, so superabundance and something, and think that this would be to your good. So you both have to leave that transaction thinking that you've been in this, as we say, a win-win transaction. You're both made better off. But the point is, we don't, and it's the kind of a correct way of stating is this, that entering into such a transaction, I'm not interested in just advancing my own interests. I'm interested in his interests advancing along with mine. That's the correct account of what's going on there. So it's not, it's egoism, altruism really doesn't get that correct. So even something that you might say is very, you know, it's just like this idea of, you know, business is self-interested or it's greedy, and then we have to kind of slap virtues on top of it to make it work out well. That's not correct. I mean, even something very simple like, you know, hiring something to do something. If you have the kind of the human attitude towards this, then you view the other person as like yourself, and it's the other self, as Aristotle would say. This is the crucial concept. You have to take his good to be your own good, and that's happening even in the simplest market exchange.
Yeah. So without getting into the whole question of egoism versus altruism, my suspicion is that, you know, like a lot of listeners will at this stage of the game be questioning, you mean to tell me that it is not the case that if I affirm or pursue some good pertinent to me or affirm my own good, that I'm thereby precluding the good of the other? Or if I affirm the good or advance the good of another, I'm not thereby kind of forced into a position in which I need to deny myself in some strange fashion? That's kind of wild, because I think a lot of us just like operate within the bounds of a presumed like hedonistic paradox. Like, I can't possibly pursue my own good lest I be selfish. But I think like this dynamic that you describe of discovering that the good of the other is in fact your own good, or investing in the good of the other, not as like an act that's patronizing or condescending or goody two shoeing, but that's, yeah, like metaphysically far richer or with roots that stretch far deeper. Could you maybe describe that, like the basis of that more fundamental affirmation, so as to kind of, yeah, maybe just kind of bring us wholly beyond the question of altruism and egoism?
Well, I'm really an Aristotelian through and through. So, I mean, Aristotle thinks of the nature of things. So if I say Aristotle, I would say myself too, because I've come to think in this way. Aristotle thinks of the nature of things as revealed and where they come from. So you really don't grasp what something is until you see how it originated and how it was generated, so to speak. This is what he says at the beginning of the Politics. You have to look at the elements out of which the city-state develops in order to understand the city-state. And this is very organic. It's similar to, you know, for example, I love wine and I love cheeses. Well, there's a certain wine that comes from a certain area in Italy. You have to understand where it came from in order to understand the wine itself. So I think that when Aristotle looks at human being, right, and you have a mature human being, you or I, for example, he thinks of a human being as having come from a family. Right? So you are not a Cartesian ego that's been injected into a body as a mature human being ready to engage in social contract with other like beings. You actually, for 20 years, you are, you know, cooked, so to speak, within an environment which is intended by nature to produce mature human beings. And this is already marked by personal relationships, where it's actually not even possible to conceive of yourself in a family as somebody who's not related to others. So it's extremely important to understand that in this Aristotelian point of view, we think of individual human beings as having grown and been developed within families, and that as a result, they can't but think of themselves. They may try, and then you could kind of, if you wanted to, you could work out various, so to speak, deficiencies or imbalances, almost like illnesses that people had by not thinking of themselves in the proper way. But so right from the start, when we enter into adult life and we want to advance our own interests, we can't but think of that as being related to other person's interests. It would be something like a severe deficiency, or almost the equivalent of a kind of mental illness, to think of others in some other way. And you see this in well-raised kids, right? So they are, you know, when they're 15 or 16, and they work hard and they want to hustle and they want to make money, well, right away they understand that they have to kind of think about what other people would find valuable and profitable and start playing to that and kind of adapting what they're doing to what would it help other people. And this is the way they get by in the world. They understand this right away.
That's fascinating. So maybe then bringing together some of the insights from these first few descriptions of kind of basic features or constituent parts of friendship, as you have described it in terms of social union. I'm interested in like a couple of features or further features, I suppose. Maybe they'd be more like micro features. This last point that you make about care or attention or solicitude, it's like the fact that, you know, a 16-year-old boy needs to pay attention to what his neighbors want if he's going to sell his services or sell his products in a way that will actually yield a profit. So he's not going to shovel many driveways in Florida, and he's not going to sell many cups of lemonade in the dead of winter in Alaska. So it entails, like, already there you have the groundwork for a development of a network of virtues. Like, he has to pay attention, he has to care, he has to be tuned in, he's got to be savvy. Like, we have various ways by which to describe it. Can you maybe just take us through some of, like, the familial or the social mediation of that growth and virtue? Because I think right now, like, people just, they like look at the product of a family and they're like, holy smokes, what went terribly wrong? I mean, in large part right now, we're doing like the COVID blame game. It's like 3 years of dissociation. But I think that we've kind of forgotten how this works, or we've forgotten how it works well.
Well, I mean, this is interesting. First of all, we could turn to Harrison Butker and his, you know, his speech at Benedictine College. You know, developmental psychologists used to say this all the time, that it's essential to good human development that you have to grow up in the presence of somebody for whom, you know, the fact that you smile or you lift up your fork in a certain way is absolutely delightful to this person. So we turn what we've been given. So, you know, right from the start, we want it to be the case that the child is adored. Right. And okay, you can ask, well, isn't that, you could be some kind of egalitarian, ideological egalitarian, and say, well, isn't that the work of the father just as much as the mother? And anybody who has knows anything, or anyone who's even been a child, would understand that no, I really didn't care for my father to adore me, and it would mean nothing. Right. So right from the start, you have to say something that's really, I mean, if you say it, you're going to get in trouble. Harrison Butker's obviously in trouble for having said this. Right. But we really want mothers to dote on their kids, because this is the way in which you might want to say concretely the dignity of the human person is conveyed to somebody. And it really ought to be the case that when you fall in love, when you look at yourself, father, and your vocation, right, in the eyes of God, you see something that will just want to make you gush, right? So it's hard to look at ourselves that way because we're so aware of our shortcomings, but we're supposed to, right, as sons and daughters of God. But where could we possibly learn that from? Because, you know, frankly, no one out there is ever going to look at us in that way. So this is like the first thing. You have to have a sense of the preciousness of the individual human person. And I'm not sure you get that easily anywhere except by having someone dote on you. And I don't see how that's going to typically. Now, all these things we say, and as a good Aristotelian, you know, Aristotle has this great phrase, hos epi to palu, which is, means for the most part or typically. And it's not a statistical idea. It's an inclination, a propensity idea that nature is arranged in this way, that it wants to affect this in a typical path, and we have to respect that and try to bring it about. So we want to try to bring it about that, you know, the mother can raise her own child. This is Catholic teaching. On Twitter today, I was posting an excerpt from Laborum Exertions of Pope John Paul II. He says, yes, of course, we want to, the concept of a just wage means that we have to make it possible for a mother, if she wants, to stay at home with their children and not go into the workplace. A lot of mothers, if they could do that, would choose to do that. And this is good. This is good for the development of the children. Okay, so that, like, we could sit here and really, Father, we could talk for 20 hours about this, but I'm just telling you the very first thing. And this very first thing is not popular. Nobody wants to hear this, and nobody really wants to do it.
Yeah. Then maybe we could just dig a little deeper. I was thinking about this maybe just last night and chatting with one of the brothers. You know, so apropos of the Harrison Butker commentary, we were just thinking about the institution of marriage, and we're trying to wrap our heads around headship, because obviously headship is a hard thing around which to wrap one's head. But it seems like the scriptural analogy is, you know, as Christ is head of the church, so man is head of the woman. It seems to describe something about order, something about governance, something about perfection, not that man is of a greater dignity insofar as both are made to the image and likeness of God on the basis of the same principles. But it seems like God intends that there be a certain order, a certain governance, a certain perfection that's at work in marriage. And if one says nothing else, it seems like we as human beings who live kind of in this mixed relation of creation dependent upon God for the whole of our life are meant to live that dependence kind of consciously, deliberately, intentionally in our relationships. And it seems like the promise of the 20th century is you don't need to be dependent. And in sowing seeds of independence, we've reaped a harvest of sadness, loneliness, societal and political destruction. So it seems like, okay, the relationship that you describe of a child coming into the world loved by its mother, conscious of the fact that it is loved by its mother, kind of born on by the love of its mother, entails some kind of recognition of one's dependence as, if not a good thing, at the very least a thing that ought not be rejected out of hand. How does, like, dependence feature into these social unions, and how is it that we as human beings are meant to kind of, like, embrace that, or even just, yeah, give ourselves to that?
That's a really great question, and for that you need to get my wife back on your show, because when she won the whatever it was called, the Novak Award or the Acton Award, or the Acton Institute gave her the Novak Award, her talk was on dependence as the crucial insight to freedom, which you would think is the opposite, right? So dependence is a lack of freedom. So, and I think she executed very well, and everybody said you should make a small book out of this. So this is something that she's thought a lot about. Aristotle, again, Aristotle, and I could say myself, but, you know, it's really not my idea. It's Aristotle's idea. Aristotle, but I believe it, Aristotle said that the sources and springs of constitutional government, and I think what he means is exactly what you were saying, some kind of ordered way of working together with others and on the largest scale and the most important matters, and understanding that is stable and settled, right? He thinks that's in the household, that comes in the household. No, he doesn't use the term headship, by the way. Pius XI does in Castia Canubi. He says the man is the head of the family, the woman is the heart of the family. And this is kind of standard or classical Catholic language to speak in this way. And of course, headship comes from St. Paul as well. But this is a very subtle thing. And what your comment indicates is that, first of all, it's political. Like, this ramifies throughout all of society. This lack, this desire not to be dependent affects all of our relationships, and not just persons in our own household or in the workplace. So this is Aristotle's insight. There's something that's most basic. He thinks in the end it's a person's relationship to himself. And here we might think of, you know, the classic Christian idea of interiority and pursuit of holiness as fostering a kind of internal environment, which is conducive to being correctly related to others. Of course, sin has to be dealt with, because that's also Christian wisdom, that in a break or division with God, we have division in ourselves and then division with others. So the relationship to God is most fundamental, even more fundamental than ourselves, which Aristotle did not see. But I think that that's true. But then this notion that if we don't properly attend to this, then we get absurd exaggerations. So you have these kind of abusive machismo men who, you know, grab women by the hair and drag them around, this kind of thing. And it's probably because of an awareness of these machismo men that you know, a lot of clerics and maybe some popes, and Pope John Paul II, I think, too, didn't want to play up that aspect of headship. I think he thought he needed to attend to complementary ideas. And he does emphasize equality. Well, there is equality. Look, I'm married to a very, very strong woman, as you know. And there's a quality. But sometimes headship does need to be shown, right? And it's very subtle. Now you need to ask Catherine and myself both to be on your show, and we can talk about how it realizes itself. But certainly, it isn't what C.S. Lewis called who gets the last word, who decides when there's loggerheads. Like, if you're at loggerheads, somebody has to decide. And you can't then decide each time who gets to decide, because you'll be at loggerheads about that. So it has to be settled. But more important than it's settled, the man has to actually want to claim it. Right? So this is a great failure of masculinity in our society. Men do not want to exercise their headship. They think it's somehow rude, or that it's offensive to others. Well, it is unpleasant, but temporarily, but also extremely reassuring and secure for those who under a man who understands his headship and is willing to, as you must know also from the notion of a religious authority in religious life, that a very good abbot, or what would be the correct name for the head of your house?
Prior.
Are you the prior, by any chance? No. I don't know the prior. A good prior is quite aware of his authority and exercises it when he needs to. And father and husband have to be like that. With a husband, it's, you know, it's very rare that you'd kind of pull your weight, pull your authority, and claim your authority as head to decide anything, because that would indicate, you know, some kind of unusual disagreement or lack of one mind, or even a temporary breakdown. That, of course, can happen in any relationship, but you don't want that to happen typically. But if it does have to happen, then the husband has to kind of pull rank, as they say.
Yeah, I think of, okay, so thinking about the 20th century, the sexual revolution, maybe some of the ideological kind of developments that we've seen even in the last quarter century attendant thereupon. It seems in rejecting distinction among persons, rejecting hierarchy in society or in the family, I think a lot of individuals embrace this as a mode of self-liberation because it distances them from, if not the reality, at least the fear of violence, you know, because there's a kind of deep distrust there whereby if I subject myself, if I subordinate myself, then I will suffer as a result because the person set in charge cannot possibly sympathize, cannot possibly defend, protect, provide. And even if they were able to do so, they'd probably do so in a manner in which I would be thereby kind of undignified, or my dignity would be left aside. And so I think that there's a kind of fear, there's a kind of suspicion, there's a kind of worry deep at the root. And, you know, in a Christian context, obviously we can attribute this, or at least relate it in some way or correlate it in some way to sin. And so it strikes me that it, like, we don't just come together in social unions for util purposes, like, all right, we can't propagate the species until such time as we agree on which bed to sleep in, so let's get about the business. You know, it's like, no, that there's a sense in which these social unions are actually meant to heal some of the fears, some of the worries deep at the roots of our being, which cause us these problems with authority, with hierarchy, with the organization of relationships in a way that can't be perfectly described as democratic. So can you speak maybe a little bit to, you don't have to, like, whatever, healing can sometimes be taken in a direction that's a little bit lovey-dovey, but like the healing that transpires in the setting of social unions?
Well, healing, let me see if I can get to healing, but there are a couple of other things I want to talk about first. Once again, my man Aristotle said that you can't exercise authority unless you've been under authority. And to be under authority means that you do something which is other than what you would have chosen. That's by definition to be under authority. So in your judgment, this would be the better path, but somebody else who has authority tells you to do something else, and you have to go along with it even if you think it's not the best path. That is, and it probably will prove to be the best path, actually. When you follow the authority, you'll be proved wrong more often than you're proved right in your different opinion. But what we see, you might want to say, look, this cancel culture, it's kind of wild, bad exercise of authority. People are constantly overreaching. They're not in their lane, as Harrison Butker said. They're trying to correct and check and put in place everybody, and even people on the other side of the world, because I don't think they've actually ever learned to live under authority. So that's the first thing I want to say. And the second thing I want to say to what you said is this, that like the great unknown, which Holy Spirit is the great unknown with a capital G and a capital U, but the great unknown among the works of mercy is the spiritual work of mercy of bearing with the shortcomings of others. And this is essential to living with others and to practicing friendship with others. I'll give you an example. My son's caddy, they went to the golf course the other day. The caddy master was in a bad mood. He basically, you know, for no cause whatsoever that anyone could say, you know, just kind of reamed them out, seemed to oppress them and refused to let one of them even go out and get a loop. So he basically wasted his morning. And they came back, and my wife and I said, you know, the only way to deal with this is just to suck it up and, you know, just go back and try to be as friendly and nice as you can the next time you go to the golf course, right? Because he's the caddy master. and if you like get angry with him, it's not going to help you at all. It's like it's going to be the opposite effect, right? But the point is, you know, maybe he had a fight with his wife. Maybe he's got some kind of financial issue. Maybe somebody did something cruel to him. We don't know why he was in such a bad mood, right? But we just have to put up with it. We just have to go along with it. And now, this is the most serious violation of this is divorce, right? So if you go back 100 years and read what the pontiffs were saying about divorce, they're all saying if divorce became widespread, all of these horrible things would happen in our society, right? So you find this in Leo XIII, you find this in Pius XI. You know, if were they wrong, right? Were they just saying all these things like kind of off the cuff and kind of some kind of foolish way, or they actually write about how serious and bad, how seriously bad divorce is? Because I can't find a better example of how the opposite of the corporal work, the spiritual work of mercy, bearing with the shortcomings of others, than divorce. And I can't find a better testimony to it than two people who, you know, have a lot of quirks and problems, and you know, maybe there's a lot of unpleasantness, and yet they live together until one of them dies, till death do us part. So those are the two things that that I want to draw attention to. Now, healing, you know, let's talk about bearing with the shortcomings of others in relationship to the sacrifice of our Lord, because any kind of mortification, any kind of death to self is healing in this world of sin. So I'm not going to say this is automatic if you're not a Christian, but if you're a Christian, you've been baptized, and you deliberately, with some kind of affection towards God in heaven, put up with somebody else's shortcoming, you will get a lot of graces from that. You will get a lot of healing from that, because you've been far worse towards others and towards God. And so, you know, healing requires a certain kind of realism, I think. And we learn a lot about ourselves by putting up with the faults of others.
Yeah, and just kind of attendant to your examples, you know, thinking about your son on the golf course getting reamed out by the caddy master, I think there's like a certain upsurge of righteous indignation where it's like, I should get my just desserts, right? My rights have been violated. But I think that there's a way in which like social unions or friendships open up to us the prospect of something more than getting our just desserts or not having our rights violated, because we're made for something more. So maybe in the time that we have remaining, right, this idea of love in a certain sense outstripping justice, or love while not transgressing justice, yet taking in a broader interpersonal communion or engendering amongst persons a richer appropriation of what's good in life. Can you speak to that just a little bit?
Well, this is a great theme in the ancient world, that justice is a highly imperfect virtue. Now, our society, you're talking about general problems in society, takes justice to be pretty much the preeminent virtue. But justice is a very primitive virtue, and it basically just prevents harms, and it doesn't do much more than that, or that's what it would do. And because it's focused on harms, it's therefore causes people to focus on themselves. And it's that great scene in the Bible. I'm sure a lot of people, you know, scratch their heads over it, where one of the man shouts out to Jesus, "Tell my brother to share his inheritance with me." And Jesus says, "You know, who made me judge over you?" It's like he just doesn't even want to go near this claim of justice, which so often is bound up with selfishness and self-assertion and pride, and also blind, because almost everybody pleading a cause of justice sees only one side, right? That famously, they just see their own side. So justice is self-centered. It nurses. It leads to anger. It tends to be partial. It's an extremely imperfect virtue, necessary, of course, but best exercised by somebody who's at arm's length from the cause rather than involved in the cause, right? So it used to be the case that if you were pressing your own cause in a claim of justice, somebody would say, well, hold on there. Let's be a little bit balanced. Let's calm down. Don't rush to judgment and so on. But now that's regarded as the fact that somebody's like steaming angry is regarded as evidence that they're in the right and they're just. It's completely wrong. So justice is, whereas you know, the old maxim is people are just, they need friendship or love. If they have love, then they don't need justice. So because love freely goes beyond any kind of, like you try to estimate in your dealings with another person what would be fair. And if you love the other person, then you count his advantage as your own advantage. You're quite happy to err on the side of like plenitude in this judgment of fairness. You know, suppose you go on a trip with somebody and you're kind of keeping an account of how much you're spending and you want to split the expenses 50-50. And there's some kind of like unclarity about, you know, this expense and that expense. At the end of the day, you could just argue about it. And you probably would never come to an agreement, and your friendship might be damaged. Or one person could just say, look, it'd be great for me if you had this extra money. I'd be happy to give it to you. Here you go. And that settles it immediately.
Yeah, I again, against the backdrop of the contemporary culture in which everyone is insisting on rights, whether real or imagined, or insisted to such a degree that they become in turn beyond legal fiction. I think it's in part, you know, attributable to this phenomenon that people are so miserable. I was talking to a sociologist who studies post-war Japan, and he was saying you have these two sites, these two cities in which atomic bombs were dropped. And the one place, they kind of memorialize it as a scar in the earth, and the other place where it, you know, exploded over the cathedral, you know, like the Catholic Church, they chose to rebuild. And I think there's a sense in which, like, the kind of victimhood culture, contemporary victimhood culture, can't get beyond, it's not even real justice. It's a simulacrum of justice, but it can't get beyond justice. It can't get into the space of forgiveness, because there's a certain power in holding on to one's resentment. And there's a kind of fear that if one lets go of his or her resentment, that then opens you up to a whole new round of violence. Maybe, you know, does Aristotle or the ancient tradition have some insights as to the kind of power, as it were, of forgiveness for liberation of the other, for liberation of oneself, or kind of what role this plays in going beyond a limited justice and then stepping into an unlimited love?
Well, you will find in the ancients, and I'll talk about Aristotle, the idea that we are meant to be in society with one another and therefore have some kind of affection, call it civic friendship if you want. And in order to have some kind of affection, you need to be prepared not to stand on your rights, but to sacrifice your rights just as a kind of favor to another person. Because the kind of the essence of justice is claiming what is your due, but the essence of love is to give something that's your own freely to another person as a gift. So if you give up what's your due and you don't insist on it, it's basically the equivalent of giving a gift to another person. So you're in line, a stock example in the supermarket. You've got a whole bunch of stuff you're going to buy at the checkout counter, and some, you know, woman comes along with baby on her arm, and she's got whatever, you know, a container of milk, and she just, or diapers, and she just wants to buy this one item. You could stand on your rights. She has no right to get ahead of you in line. But if you say, go ahead of me, and most people do this, right? It's not a very difficult thing to do, but it's still very friendly, because what you're doing is you're giving up a little bit of your time that you didn't have to give up, and that's what makes it a free gift. And so now you're friendly towards this other person. So this virtue, we're back to the virtues, right? Aristotle, was in the ancient world, was called epiecheia, and he even uses the term epieches for kind of a typical word for a virtuous person. So he always thinking about the plenitude of the perfection of something. So somebody who's reached kind of the perfection of sociability is going to easily to show this kind of attitude towards others in civic life. Now, Christianity gives us something a whole lot more powerful than that, which is in so many parables of our Lord, right? How can we go and run out and start choking somebody saying, you know, repay your debt? When we've just been forgiven, like this massive debt that's a million times larger than what we're choking this other person for. So what we're seeing in our society, you've rightly drawn attention to some extent, the result of the breakdown of marriage. Small families, we haven't mentioned. Right, because in a large family, there's always a hierarchy. Aristotle mentions the older siblings have authority, and they exercise it over younger siblings. And so you never live as an equal. But if you're homeschooled, you're never really an equal with anybody. But if you go to, I call them government schools. If you go to government school, then you're thrown in with everybody your same age, and at least in the ideology of the school, you're equal with all those other people. Of course, there would be bullies, and so instead of older siblings who maybe will boss you around a little bit, you have bullies, and then you have the fashionable people and the trendsetters and the prestigious people. You have something that's far worse, right? That's actually taking place of what's happening in the family. But another thing we have to really account for is the lack of self-knowledge that in the eyes of God, we're deep, 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 deep debtors who've been forgiven our sins, and we're in really no position to go around strangling our brothers and sisters and insisting that they pay us their due, what's due to us.
Yeah. No, that might be a beautiful point at which to arrive. Maybe if you have any final thoughts or final commendation of either Aristotle's teaching on the theme or of contemporary studies of the theme, or just any other insights that you think are worthwhile inserting at this point as we kind of wrap up our discussion of or meditation on social union cum civic friendship.
Right now I'm putting together a book of essays and the very first essay is called Natural Law and Civil Society. I'm very interested in natural law, but I've come to see that the lawyerly way in which we do tend to discuss natural law as the basis of a legal system is really not correct. In this Aristotelian way of looking at society, natural law is something like an inbuilt framework for associating with others, for sowing sociability. Obviously, if you're stealing somebody's property, you can't be sociable towards them. Social union will not work. So it's kind of like supplying the bare conditions for social unions to form. So at this book, which I can't name the press that's looking at it, but I think it would be very helpful it's going to put together natural law and this kind of rich conception of a civil society, a free society, because we've also, our age is an age of just splitting things apart that belong together, as you've said, Father. So this is something that we've done. But other than that, Thomas Aquinas, in our discussions back and forth just now, we've easily moved from a classical Aristotelian point of view to how Christianity is so in harmony with it, but also supports it and brings out things and makes possible a kind of daring extreme of virtue, if you will. And who embodies that better than St. Thomas Aquinas? So I would recommend his treatment of love, the passion of love, in the first part of the Summa, and then the first part of the second part of the Summa, and then charity in the second part of the second part of the Summa. People can read these things. They can, if they work at it, they can get a lot out of it.
They can indeed. All right. Well, thanks so much for taking the time, and thanks for the members of your household who made it possible. Corralling the dog and other such things.
Indeed. Yeah. Okay. Thanks. Thank you, Father.
Sure. Turning to you, the listener, thanks so much for tuning into this episode of the Thomistic Institute podcast. If you haven't yet, subscribe on YouTube or on your podcast app. unless you find that it's better to pass significant chunks of your day in silence, upon which don't bother subscribing, and run to the countryside, buy yourself 3 acres and a cow, and enjoy your beautiful life. Know of our prayers for you. Please pray for us, and we'll look forward to chatting with you next time on the Thomistic Institute podcast.